You know, I think sometimes people think that poetry is, being a poet is sort of a spiritual condition, but you actually have to be good at writing, and that means being good at the school subject called English.
Welcome to In Writing. I'm Hattie Crissell, and this is a new podcast that gets into the heads and the studies of wonderful writers of all kinds and asks them how they do it, where they do it, and what they can teach us about doing it better. For today's episode, I travel to Ely, Cambridgeshire to visit the poet Wendy Cope. A bit about Wendy if you're not familiar. She was born in 1945 and was a primary school teacher until in 1986 she published her first poetry collection, Making Cocoa, for Kingsley Amis. It was an enormous success and a bestseller, but as she told me, she was not embraced by the poetry community at the time. That didn't stop her. Since then, she's published four more collections, including If I Don't Know in 2001, which was shortlisted for the Whitbread Poetry Award. Her work can be very funny and often very moving. In person, she was exactly what I'd hoped she'd be, very sharp, quite frank, and with a dry sense of humour. She shares her home with her husband, the poet Lachlan McKinnon. It's a tucked away cottage, and I arrived on a summer day when she had all the windows closed because of hay fever. She showed me down a narrow hallway packed with books to her study at the back of the house, and we chatted there. One apology I have to make is that there's some occasional interference in the sound. Apologies for that, and I hope it doesn't bother you. Now, over to Wendy. It was the first thing I noticed is books everywhere. You've got books in the hall when you come in, books in the downstairs loo.
Yeah.
Is there
and
a room?
There's millions more upstairs as well.
Yeah.
And in the garage. And we got rid of about 2,000 books before we moved, and we've got rid of a few more, quite a few more since we moved. But then every Christmas and birthday we get more. I mean, what I do now is I read a novel, I give it away straight away.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm. So what does a book have to be to classify, you know, to qualify?
Well, poetry books might come in. I mean, you know, there's lots of poetry books there that I haven't read and probably aren't going to. I'm not going to read, as well as a lot that I have read. But, you know, I might need to look something up.
Yeah.
Or he might need to look something up. You know, quite often he says, have you got a copy of X's book that he needs to look at? And quite often I have. So I think I have to hang on to those for the moment. But I'm thinking of getting rid of more novels. I mean, I have kept some favourite novels, but I don't know if I'm going to read them again. And then, I don't know. I mean, I need to get rid of some more.
Yeah.
But
they're lovely.
I mean, I don't think I can get rid of these for the moment, even the ones I don't really want to read or can't read.
Yeah,
I find them unreadable.
This bookshelf in your study seems to be exclusively poetry.
It's just poetry,
yeah.
And it's just, you know, one poet collections, anthologies. There's some anthologies there, and there's some out in the corridor, and there's some poetry in translation out in the corridor as well.
What are your favourite things in here?
Well, I like the piano.
Is this your mother's piano?
Yeah, that's right. And, well, up there, there's... Oh, I know. The portrait of Roger. See the picture of the teddy bear up there? That's by Posy Simmons.
Oh, wow.
And it was commissioned for the cover of my second book, Serious Concerns. There's a couple of poems in it that are by Roger Bear. And I wanted a picture of Roger Bear on the cover reading a serious book.
Yeah.
And Christopher Reed, who was my editor, suggested T.S. Eliot's Note Towards the Definition of Culture.
Yeah.
So that is Roger Bear reading Notes Towards the Definition of Culture. And he had to go and stay with Posy, which was a bit of a wrench for me. He had to go and stay with Posy. And it's a very flattering... I mean, he's much more battered than he looks in that picture.
That's kind of Posy to take a few years off him then. Was Roger Bear your toy from childhood?
Yes,
then?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's lovely. So I know that you've said in a few interviews and things in the last few years that you write a sort of handful of poems a year. Is that still right?
At the moment I'm not writing any poems at all. And I don't know if I will. I have a feeling that my work is finished. And I don't feel worried about that. But you can't tell what would happen. You know, Fleur Adcock, whose work you may know, this poet I think is really good, she had a long period in her 60s where she thought she'd finished writing and she wasn't upset about it.
Yeah.
But then she suddenly started again.
Yeah.
And she's written a lot more since then. So I don't know. But at the moment, I don't really have any urge to write.
When you do feel the urge coming on to write a poem, how does that work? Is it something that you've kind of written in your head before you ever sit down, or...?
Sometimes, with the very short ones, I sometimes write them in my head before I write anything down. But that's unusual. You know, some of my poems are very short.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have thought them up in my head before I've written anything down, but not usually. So usually it starts with some words that I think could be part of a poem. And all poets will tell you that. It starts with some words. And you think, oh, that could be a line of a poem. And then you take it from there.
And then at some point you feel interested enough in those words to come and sit down and start playing around with it. How long does it usually take? Is that a ridiculous question?
Well, it depends. But say a sonnet, which is something there's a lot of sonnets in my most recent book, as you may have noticed. And I think of that as a morning's work and probably not a 4-hour morning. I find actually when I'm writing poems, I do actually run out of energy after about 40 to 45 minutes. I run out of energy. I have to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so I'll do 2 or 3 sessions of 40 minutes in a morning. And by then I will usually have a first draft. And sometimes I think it's finished. But what tends to happen is I think it's finished, but then I go over it in my head over the next day or two and I realise there's room for improvement as I change it a bit.
So you keep coming back to it?
Yeah, until it doesn't seem to need changing anymore.
And I think I'm right in saying you've said that sometimes a poem will sort of sit in the background somewhere for a long time and then you'll find it and think, oh, actually...
Occasionally happens. Perhaps not as much as it used to.
Who is usually the first person that you share poems
to? Well, these days it's Lachlan.
Yeah.
But it used to be various poet friends. But these days it's always Lachlan. But it's very important to realise... I mean, I say this to students in the days when I used to do some teaching. It's very important if you're going to show your poems to anyone, to show them to more than one person, because nobody is infallible.
Mm. And everything's subjective, I suppose, to an extent.
Well, it's not completely subjective. I mean, there is, you know, I judge poetry competitions. You know, I can tell the difference between a good poem and a bad one. But between the good poems, different judges might have preferences.
Yeah.
You know, although, I mean, no poet who's with any, you know, sense of what, you know, I mean, you can tell a really bad poem and you dismiss it. But, you know, there will be quite a few good ones and it might be hard to decide which of those good ones actually deserves first prize. And so there is an element of luck in all these competitions. There's an element of luck about the judge's taste.
Are you somebody who has rituals around writing? Are there things that you need in place on your desk?
No, or... I've never got into that.
Really?
No, I know. I mean, because I find it slightly irritating. And when people talk like that, and I think that, you know, you want to be as flexible as possible. You want to make it as easy as possible for yourself to write. And if you've got to be in a particular place with, you know, all that sort of thing.
Special pen or...
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, some of my poems are written away from home. I travel around doing poetry readings. I quite often find myself alone in a hotel room or on a train. Trains aren't so good because they're too bumpy. But I've written quite a bit when I've found myself alone in a hotel room. That can be quite fruitful. I certainly don't want... And, you know, I still write all my poems longhand before they get typed out. So I don't need to take a laptop with me. I don't need anything. And I can write it on the back of an envelope.
Is there a particular time of day when you find that you're more inclined to
These days, work? Mostly... These days, anything productive I mostly do in the mornings.
Yeah.
It's changed. When I was younger, I quite often wrote at night. I'd often get ideas late at night. And, you know, when I had a job, it was a real pain because I didn't want to be kept awake by a poem if I had to get up in the morning. When I stopped having to get up in the morning, it sort of stopped happening. These days, I get tired. Yeah. I mean, these days, I go to bed earlier. I wake up earlier. I'm old. And so I don't have the end. I mean, you know, it's in the mornings. That's when I work.
Yeah. What are your first memories of writing?
Well, I wrote a poem when I was 6. The only time I was told to write a poem at school was when I was 6, and I wrote a poem about Roger. Wasn't very good. And then I was good at writing at school, but I just didn't write poems. When I was 7 or 8, I used to write stories in my spare time and say I wanted to be a writer. And then I forgot all about it and came back to it in my 20s. But I didn't say I wanted to be a poet. I thought I would write stories. But yeah. It turned out differently. No.
And so when did it become a more serious
In my late 20s. Partly, one thing was I was a primary school teacher and I was doing a lot of creative work with the children. And that was one of the things that got me going. Another thing that I was in psychoanalysis and I sort of got in touch with feelings that I hadn't been aware of and I needed a way of expressing them. And the third thing, I think, that as I was living on my own, I'd had lived with flatmates and the nice ones had got married and I got fed up with the others, so I went and lived on my own. And there was no one at home to talk to, and that was also quite important.
Because you felt you had to get things out and...
Yeah, I mean, if there's no one to talk to, that is a incentive for writing. And when I first started living with Lachlan, I didn't write much at first. I mean, I had to learn how to shut myself away, even though there was someone to talk to.
But when did it become something where, you know, you actually started making some money off it? And because I know you were a teacher for a long time.
Yes, I was a teacher. And, well, you know what happens with poetry? Some of your poems get published in magazines and then...
Is that how it started?
That's how it
started. You started sending
things
in.
That's the normal way. You send poems to magazines, preferably the more prestigious ones like the Times Literary Supplement. And, you know, then you need a bit of a track record of being published in magazines, really, before publisher will want to look at you for a book. That's the usual way. But really, I went freelance after my first book was published because it got lots of publicity. It sold very well. And I started being asked to do all kinds of things. And there wasn't really time to go to work anymore.
Yeah.
Because I was asked to do so many things.
Do you remember what your first poem was that was published and where?
Yes, it was called Lonely Heart. Well, the very first one to be published was... It was by Fleur Adcock in a thing called Pen Broadsheet, which was a thing published by the organising Pen. Fleur was a teacher on a course I was on as a student, an Arvon course, and two or three of us had poems that she wanted to publish. You know, she was looking for things by new poets, really, to put in this thing. And I can't remember, I think it might have been a poem about my sister. And that was, you know, I've always been grateful to Fleur for that, but actually the big breakthrough was when I got a poem called Lonely Hearts in the Times Literary Supplement. That was, yeah. You can be published in small publications forever, it doesn't make any difference.
Were you ecstatic? Do you remember how you felt?
I was excited, yes. Yeah. Well, what happened was I was going to these evening classes run by Blake Morrison, who, when I started going to his classes, was a PhD student who no one had heard of. But during the course of that time I was there, he became poetry editor of the TLS. And I, you know, after a while I took along a poem that he really liked, and so he put it in the TLS. And then there was a magazine called Quarto, and Blake persuaded me, it was edited by Craig Rain at the time, and Blake persuaded me to send poems to him.
Mm.
And then I got asked to do a radio... I invented this character called Strugnell, and I got asked to write a radio programme about Strugnell and his friends and their poetry group in Tulse Hill.
Yeah.
And someone at Faber heard that, Robert McCrum, and he said to Craig, are we publishing this woman? And I think, you know, Craig was thinking about it anyway, but, you know, I'd already, before Craig was even at Faber, I'd been asked to send some poems to be considered for a book called Poetry Introduction 5, which was they did a series of these books that were, you know, five or six new poets who hadn't got to the stage of publishing a book. And so I got this letter from Faber saying, would I send some poems? And I was in this book, and it was the most exciting thing. Nobody bought this book, nobody read it, you know, but it was still the most exciting thing that ever happened to me.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what happened then was you had to sign a piece of paper giving Faber first option on your collection. Well, nobody mind doing that. And after a few years, then Craig was there. And after a few years, it became clear that he wanted to publish a collection. But we weren't in a hurry, either of us. And I think a lot of people are in too much of a hurry to publish their first book.
And you've now done how many collections?
It's five.
Five. So you're not sort of belting them out every year?
I've done more than Larkin.
Yeah.
But then I've lived 10 years longer than Larkin did already.
Well.
Yeah.
Have there been particular teachers or mentors early on in your life who you think made all the difference when it came to your writing?
No, I don't think so. Nobody encouraged me to write that I remember, although I was good at English.
Yeah.
And that's what you need. I mean, when kids ask me about being a poet, I say you have to be good at English or whatever language you want to write in.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes people think that poetry is being a poet is sort of a spiritual condition, but you actually have to be good at writing. And that means being good at the school subject called English.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it's always clear to people that that is what it's about.
Yeah, it's not just whimsically putting a few nice words down on the page.
Well, I'm sure you were. I'm sure you were very good at English at school, or you wouldn't have been able to become a freelance writer.
To what extent do you think writing is learnable? You know, if
I think with a few pointers in the right direction, people can improve enormously.
Yeah.
And with some encouragement, you know, from people who you respect, who think your work is promising, that obviously give you a huge boost. But also that, you know, I do really think with a few pointers in the right direction, people can improve enormously.
Yeah. Do you feel that you have, can you see improvement in your work when you look back over the last, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got early poems that, you know, before I was publishable, I've got early poems. And what I can see now is that some of them read like poor imitations of Sylvia Plath, and some of them read like poor imitations of T.S. Eliot. But I didn't realise it at the time. But actually, there's nothing, I mean, that's a perfectly respectable journey, because it shows at least I was reading.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfectly respectable journey. I think this happens to a lot of people. And I remember the first time I judged the National Poetry Competition, some of the better poems were sort of imitations of Seamus Heaney.
Right.
Now, they weren't going to win any prizes, but you thought those people might well get somewhere.
Right.
If they got to the point of imitating Seamus Heaney, yeah, then they might work their way through to their own voice and they would have learned a lot.
Yeah.
The bad ones, the really bad ones, where people didn't appear to ever have read anything.
Yeah. And the ones who saw it as a spiritual pursuit rather than a discipline. Do you think that you've changed as a poet at all?
I mean, becoming, you know, having humour in my poems was a development, because my early poems didn't have any. I mean, some of them quite, you know, the things I quite like about those early poems, but they, it was, to begin with, I never had any jokes in my poems. And then I decided to let my sense of humour into my poems. So obviously that was quite an important development. And also I just realised that I sort of had this idea that rhyme and metre were terribly old-fashioned and you couldn't do that nowadays except when you were writing comic verse. But then I realised you could. I mean, I came across writers like James Fenton and Tony Harrison who were using rhyme and metre and not just in funny poems.
Yeah.
So that was quite important. So I started doing that a lot. Although, you know, there's always been quite a few poems in my most recent book that are not in traditional forms because I was beginning to find it too restricting. But there are still quite a lot that are.
Yeah.
I'm not as funny as I used to be. When I was more miserable, I was funnier.
Well, I did find that reading Anecdotal Evidence, wherever it is, here it is, made me cry quite a few times.
Good. I know when anyone says that, I say, oh, good, another notch on the desk.
Yeah, and sort of quite, I do most of my reading in the bath, and I found myself suddenly crying quite unexpectedly reading a couple of them. There's one in particular which I've read several times and still makes me feel a bit tearful, which is the one about your parents visiting you at university.
Yeah.
In here somewhere, an afternoon, is it called?
Yes, it's called an afternoon, yeah.
Which is just, very, very moving.
Thank you.
Thanks for making me cry. What makes a good poem for you?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, it's really almost impossible to answer that.
Well, what are you striving for?
Being truthful. And the thing, you know, again, I learned a lot from judging competitions. There's something I call authenticity of tone, which means you feel that this is the poet's real voice. They're not putting on, you know, a mistake beginner writers often make is putting on a special voice for poetry and using poetic words. Not good, you know, but you've somebody you feel is just telling it as they see it. And they're not putting on airs, they're just being honest. And I think that's probably what I think what poet is trying to do is to say how it is or how it was as accurately as possible, to find the words to be as accurate as possible.
Mm. You have written prose.
Yeah.
And you published this sort of collected book of bits and bobs of prose, Life, Love and the Archers. Mm. What is the difference in experience for you between sitting down to write poetry and sitting down to write something else?
Sometimes writing prose can seem wonderfully easy, actually. Although I think it's just as important. I think the thing about poets are they're people who are prepared to work on something very small and get it just right.
Mm, obsessive, is it fair to say?
Oh, yes. But, you know, doing these spectator diary pieces, I quite like the bit that they've just little paragraphs, not one whole long piece. I think that, you know, the rhythm is just as important in prose, and just, you know, getting every word just right is just as important in prose.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I suppose prose is easier, and yet I don't seem to be able to write a prose book. I mean, that prose book is just pieces, small short pieces put together.
Yeah.
Most of them were commissioned. So
why do you think...
I don't seem to have the stamina or the confidence. Well, you know, I've never been seized by an idea for a novel. And I think to write a novel, you have to be seized by an idea.
Mm.
And I think perhaps I'm just not very interested in making things up.
Yeah.
I'm interested... There's an expression of Seamus Heaney's, the music of what happens. And I think that's what I'm interested in.
Right.
Rather than making things up. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. You know, there is some fiction. There's some fiction in my poems. You know, there's those long poems, The Teacher's Tale and The River Girl, that are fiction. But I think I'm not terribly interested in making things up, or not very good at making things up. So if I was going to write a prose book, I think it'd probably be non-fiction, but I'm far too lazy to research a biography. So,
but you, I mean, you, I think you talk, I think it might be in the intro to Life, Love and the Archers, you say you have tried once or twice to write a memoir and you've ended up with sort of bits and pieces of memoir.
Yes.
I mean, you wouldn't have to put a lot of research into that, presumably.
No, I did start writing a memoir at a time when I wasn't writing any poems, but I wasn't very satisfied with it. And I tell you what happened, it got really difficult. It was quite easy to write about my childhood, and a lot of that is in that book. But when it got to sort of university and it's people that I still know.
Right.
You know, I mean, I've written a bit about my relationship with Lachlan, and he's okay with that.
Have you written it very movingly?
But he sees that. I mean, you know, it just got too difficult.
Are you worried about hurting somebody's feelings? I mean, are you worried about hurting somebody's feelings?
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, there are poems that I haven't published. There are some poems, I mean, some poems about... I can write more freely about my childhood and my mother, but there are one or two poems that I didn't publish while my mother was alive.
Yeah.
And there's one... all the poems about... All the sort of poems from the years of my miserable love life, they're about so many different people, except there's one called My Lover, where the guy is very recognisable. So I went, you know, I said, are you sure? His name is Robert. I said, are you sure, Robert? Are you sure you're okay with this? But he loved it. And what happened was people recognised him and said, oh, I didn't know you knew Wendy Cope. He absolutely loved it. But I did ask him.
That's what I want to know more about. I want a memoir all about those relationships, because you write about them so sort of intriguingly in Making Cocoa
for Kingsley
Amis.
The thing is,
they're
not all dead.
Yeah.
I mean, he is. And at his funeral, I said to his daughter, would she like me, if this poem is republished, because I want to do a collected poems, would she like me to make it in memory of her father? And she said, yes.
Oh, that's
so
lovely.
I will.
Yeah.
But I didn't think that was, you know, obviously it wouldn't have been appropriate while he was alive.
No.
But I will do that, because he died a few years ago. But, you know, they're not all dead. And I really can't do that, can I?
No.
What I can't bear is when people think that once or twice, you know, people have thought that poems were about Lachlan that, you know, aren't about Lachlan. I mean, you know, none of the nasty ones are about Lachlan. And sometimes when people have thought, you know, he's very good like that, but they're not about him.
Yeah.
And I don't like it if people think that they are, because I wouldn't do that.
When Making Cocoa for Kingsley Amis was published, it became very successful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the impression I get is sort of almost quite surprisingly successful, in the sense that it was a poetry book, and they
the first
were,
book of
yeah,
poems.
The first, yeah,
it was very. I, you know, I don't know how many first books of poems have ever sold as well.
Yeah.
As mine did. And it was a mixed blessing because it made me very unpopular with some other poets, and I've had a rather difficult relationship with the poetry world ever since. Now, I've got lots of friends who are poets, and some of them are people who were thought I was terrible. And, you know, it helps when you get to know them.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some, you know, I've got some poets who've always been very supportive and very nice to me. But, you know, what you notice is the hostility. And certainly one time, you know, I'd be introduced to some poet I'd never met, and they'd look at me as if they were being asked to shake hands with Hitler. I mean, there really was a huge amount of prejudice against me. And one time I got involved with a man, a male poet and publisher, who he fell in love with me. So then he read my book, but he said, you know, he was convinced that, you know, I was this terrible woman that English poetry need to be rescued from. And then he read me and he said, you're a good poet. You're a good.
Oh, thanks.
But I mean, that's how it was.
Yeah.
I was a student from Edinburgh University, nice chap, who came to see me because he wanted to write his long essay about my work. And his tutor didn't know anything about it, had never read it. And so he said, well, you know, I'll buy you a copy. I'd only published one book, I think, at the time. He said, I'll buy it for you. And the tutor said, even if you buy it for me, I'm not going to read that. That's the kind of prejudice there was.
What was that really all about? Do you think it was...
Sexism, I think it was partly just very difficult for poets when, you know, their books aren't selling much and they haven't got many readers, and then someone pops up and, you know, they might, you know, I think people thought I was a sort of middle class Pam Ayres and not really writing proper poems. You know, when Pam Ayres came on the scene, poets were so horrible about her, unbelievably horrible about her. Mm. You know, I mean, Pam Ayres, she's never claimed to be anything that she isn't. She knows she's not T.S. Eliot. She keeps well away from the poetry world. She has absolutely nothing to do with it. She's very good at what she does. She's a very talented woman. She's, she's intelligent. But it's not serious. I mean, you know, it's not serious poetry. It's not literary. I mean, I suppose that's the main thing. You know, it's not really literary. And, you know, so I think I'm very different from her. But I think when somebody comes along who's popular, there's always the consoling idea is that, well, they're no good.
Right. So it's jealousy, really.
Yes, a lot of it is. Well, envy. A lot of it is. You know, some of them may have read my work and decided it wasn't any good. And then if you think someone's no good, and, you know, I mean, there are these Instagram poets at the moment.
Yes.
They're no good and they're terribly popular and it's very annoying.
You find it annoying?
Yes.
Yeah. When that book was so successful, I mean, that must have been quite an odd experience.
It was, because I was just a primary school teacher and suddenly the phone kept ringing. People asking me to do things. I wasn't very good at saying no. You know,
yeah.
I mean, after a few weeks, my publishers took me out to lunch and said, don't do anything for less than £100. This was 1986, when £100 was worth more. And I said, oh, but I've already arranged to do things for the next 6 months for less than £100. you know, because it was horrible, actually. I mean, people got at me. I really began to feel there's all these people out there that want to exploit me.
Yeah.
And I had to get tough very quickly.
Yeah. And stop saying yes to those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it change?
But it's terribly difficult to ask for more money or to say, no, I'm not going to do this for nothing.
Yeah, it certainly takes a bit of practice, I think. Did the act of writing get any more difficult after that?
Yeah. Yes. I think I had to. I mean, it was, 6 years until I published another book. And I did get back into it.
Did the sort of publishing experience, dealing with a publisher and dealing with the press and all of that stuff, over your career, do you feel like that has enhanced your life of a poet or sort of
dealing
taken
with
away
the publishers is okay? I mean, they're pretty nice to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I grumble, like all authors grumble. And, you know, that first contract I had without an agent, I was ripped off. But that was a long time ago. I haven't really got any complaints about my publishers now. They're pretty nice. But dealing with the press is a nightmare. I mean,
I read
my
your
poem
about it. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, doing all those interviews, and Craig couldn't believe me when I said to Craig, what I was more worried about than anything was how I was going to look in the photographs. I was more worried about that than what anyone said about that. He couldn't believe it. He just couldn't, because he's a man. He couldn't believe it.
Right.
But I still, what still pisses me off is that, you know, when you, in becoming a poet, you don't think you're signing up for having to worry about what you look like.
Yeah. Have you ever found, you know, when your poems have been written about in the press, have you ever found journalists misinterpreting things or...
There's different kinds of reviews. There, the best ones are good reviews by people who've really understood. And then there are nice reviews full of praise by people who really haven't got the point at all.
Right, but that's so then better it's than kind being of meaningless. Nasty.
Then there are sort of mixed reviews. And I mean, what you want is intelligent reviews. And, you know, I don't mind if it's an intelligent review with a few negative things in it, but they seem intelligent, you know.
Yeah.
And then you get really spiteful reviews where the person is just determined to do you down. And that happens.
Yeah.
Especially if you know, I mean, my second book got a really terrible review in the TLS. And that matters because that's the only thing that's seen abroad. And it was completely unfair. And it was obviously, you know, because my first book had done so well and blah, blah, that, you know, he thought he'd tear me down.
Yeah.
And he is the one person. I mean, I've had other reviews that were mixed, but he is, I will not speak to that guy. And I bumped into him a couple of times at parties and been reminded who he is and said, oh, sorry, I don't speak to you, and walked away. And he's the only person I will do that to.
Yeah.
Because I was so cross about that review, which I felt he was just showing off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was really, really. What you want is intelligent reviews. That's the, even if they're not completely positive.
Yeah. When you look back over the last, when did you start writing poems? 70s?
Yeah. I started writing seriously in about 1973. Yeah.
So, which is?
83,
93,
2003.
46 years ago, something like that. Do you see patterns of periods when you were particularly fruitful and periods when you weren't? Do you think?
Yes, there definitely have been. Definitely. Periods when I've been fruitful and others when I wasn't. And earlier on, I mean, Serious Concerns, the most perceptive reviewer of that book said it was written out of deep despair.
Yeah.
And it was, but it's also my funniest book. And I think, you know, in then I was writing because life was so difficult that I really needed to write those poems to sort of help me get through.
Yeah.
But I've had other quite fruitful periods where I'm not sure what the reason was, really. I just seem to get into the flow.
It's not always unhappiness then. You've
no.
Had fruitful, happy periods as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your first book is dedicated to your psychoanalyst.
Yeah.
I mean, you've said before that psychoanalysis was very helpful in your writing. Would you just briefly explain that again?
Well, I think it was to do with getting in touch with feelings I didn't know I had. And, you know, if poetry is about telling the truth, then understanding the truth about yourself, or more of the truth about yourself, is obviously a good thing. And some writers, I believe, such as T.S. Eliot and D.H. Lawrence, to mention only two, have looked into the possibility of psychoanalysis and decided it might destroy their creativity.
Why?
And what you'd have to ask them. Because, but I mean, I think maybe it's to do with the feeling that creative people are a bit mad or something like that. I don't know. But what I think is that I don't see how understanding more of the truth about yourself could make anyone a worse writer.
Yeah.
And it also overestimates the power of psychoanalysis, because what I say to people, I'm still quite neurotic enough to get by as a poet even after 10 years in analysis. But it certainly made me, you know, more, less depressed and more confident.
Yeah.
I mean, someone once fixed me up a blind date with a psychologist. And almost as soon as we got together, he was saying, oh, psychoanalysis doesn't work. It's well known psychoanalysis doesn't work. So I thought, well, this is obviously not for me. There was not a second date. But I think, you know, a lot of people do think that, yeah.
Yeah. What are you most proud of looking back on what you've written?
Oh. Well, there's certain poems, I suppose, that I like. And I think I'm proud of the response I get from readers. I mean, it seems, you know, I get tremendous response from readers when I do readings, and, you know, people write to me all the time. And the poems seem to move people and to help them. So I'm proud of that, I suppose. I'm also proud of having written two bestsellers. It's rather annoying that my other three books didn't.
Oh, just the two bestsellers. Thank you so much to Wendy Cope, speaking to me in her study in Ely. Do buy one or all of Wendy's books. If you haven't read her work before, then I would say Making Cocoa for Kingsley Amis is a great place to start. Or Two Cures for Love, which gives a really good overview of selected poems from 1979 to 2006. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a rating and a review to help more listeners find it. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.